All right, it's 10 o'clock. Time for us to get started. We are in Joshua chapter 20 this morning. So we just finished up the inheritance. Here, the inheritance section starts in chapter 13, runs through chapter 19. We got the big conclusion to that last week. As all of these tribes who have been delaying in taking their inheritance, Joshua admonishes them that, hey, you guys need to go get your inheritance. And finally, everything is settled out. So we get this conclusion at the end of chapter 19. These are the inheritance that Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun and the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel distributed by lot at Shiloh before the Lord at the entrance of the tent of meeting. So they finished dividing the land. And while we've mentioned Shiloh, by the way, we should remember at this stage in Israel's history, the Lord has not caused his name to dwell in Jerusalem. Right? Again, we always think of Jerusalem as like the center of Israel's activity and the center of Israel's worship. At this point, it's not even really an Israelite city. All right, we've read that it's been apportioned to Benjamin, but Benjamin has not driven out the Jebusites, and neither has Judah. And it's not going to be an Israelite city, really, until the time of David. And right now, for a long time, the Lord is causing his name to dwell at Shiloh. Let's see. Let's go ahead and work on our map before we jump into chapter 20. And I tell you what, let's stretch our brains a bit and start with some of the harder ones that we don't think about as often. So let's start in the northwest corner of Israel. So we are west of the Jordan River, and on the north side, let's start here next to the coast. So far northwest. Do we remember what tribe this is? It's Asher, yes. All right, then the other big tribe, just to the east of Asher, remember which one this is. It's on the far north side. Naphtali. And we'll abbreviate that. Let's see. This little one that's kind of mushed in the middle of a bunch of the other ones. It's not Issachar, so you're very close, though. We're in the right neighborhood, but this isn't Issachar. It's not Dan. Dan is supposed to be down here. They end up here. And we'll get the full story of that. We talked about it a little bit last week. Now, the text just kind of casually tells us that, oh yeah, whenever Dan lost their inheritance, like, what? Dan lost their inheritance? What do you mean? There's a story behind that that we'll get in the book of Judges. If I'll go ahead and put Dan on the map here. This is where they're supposed to be, but that's not where they stay. They end up moving, like, up here. Okay, so it's not Issachar, though. What other options have we got? Sorry? It's a small one. It is. It was, because it's such a small space. In fact, this time I might just draw an arrow to it, or here. We'll just draw an arrow pointing in that general direction. It is Zebulun. Yeah. Zebulun is the hard one. Like, we almost never read about Zebulun, right? Zebulun's a hard one. All right. This one to the south and east of Zebulun, that's Issachar. Okay. Now we should be getting into some of the easier ones, like this big one to the south and west of Issachar. Yes, this is West Manasseh. All right, and if you know if West Manasseh is here, then their neighbor has to be, who's Manasseh's brother? Ephraim. Well, remember, Manasseh and Ephraim were different. Because Manasseh and Ephraim are not children of Jacob by birth. Who's their father? Joseph, yes. Remember, Jacob ends up adopting them at the end of Genesis, and they get an inheritance as though they are sons of Jacob, but they're sons of Joseph. And the book of Joshua treats the people of Joseph as one people. So anytime you see Manasseh, you know Ephraim's got to be nearby. Okay, so now we're kind of into the central hill country of Israel. We've already placed Ephraim, we've placed Dan. Of course, we know what this big one down here is. It's the freebie, Judah. So who's right next to Judah? This is not Gad. Gad is east of the river. It's Benjamin. Yeah. Maybe one way to remember this, I'm just going to put a letter B there. One way to remember this, I don't know if this might be helpful. Remember in Genesis, the whole story of Joseph, like when he's down in Egypt. Remember, the brothers go down there on account of the famine, except for Benjamin. Right? Why does Jacob keep Benjamin behind? It's because he's his favorite. Yeah, Benjamin is Rachel's only other son who remains. Here, Joseph, Jacob thinks, is dead. Benjamin is the only other son from his favorite wife, and so he's really protective of Benjamin. He won't send Benjamin down. And at the end of the story, or when Joseph is still pretending like he's going to imprison and possibly kill. In fact, at the end of the story, it comes around to Benjamin is charged with a capital offense, or is stealing the silver cup. Joseph has his servant put the silver cup in Benjamin's saddlebag. That's a capital offense. Benjamin is supposed to die, right? Joseph is going to kill Benjamin, and Judah steps up and intercedes and says, "Take me instead." Right? Don't hold it against Benjamin, hold it against me. And so maybe this will help you remember the placement of things. Just remember that Judah was looking out for his little brother Benjamin. Alright, big Judah looking out for little Benjamin. Alright, but we've got everything west of the river. East of the river, we've just got 2.5 tribes, and these should be relatively easy. We'll start with the big one in the north. East Manasseh. Here we go. And then from there, in the middle, Gad. Good. Gad's in the middle. And then off in the corner is Reuben. Right. There's all kinds of mnemonics you can come up with for some of these things. Yeah, I always associate that phrase, off in a corner, with Reuben. I'd forgotten what I'm going to say, so I'll move on to something else. Okay, so we've got the whole tribe map here. We're going to add something to this today. Stretch our brains just a little bit more. And this is something that, if we memorize this next part, is going to be really helpful for you later on as you're reading Israel's history. So let's get into Joshua chapter 20. This is what we're going to add to the map. Joshua chapter 20, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Say to the people of Israel, appoint the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who strikes any person without intent or unknowingly may flee there. They shall be for you a refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and explain his case to the elders of that city. then they shall take him into the city and give him a place, and he shall remain with them. And if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not give up the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor unknowingly and did not hate him in the past. And he shall remain in that city until he has stood before the congregation for judgment, until the death of him who is high priest at the time. Then the manslayer may return to his own town and his own home, to the town from which he fled. All right, so we've been given the land grants for all of the tribes. Now we have the cities of refuge that are to be set aside. This is part of one, a couple of other important land matters that have to be dealt with. So all of the tribes have received their inheritance except, of course, for Levi. And you know what? There was one other we forgot to put up on the map. Easy to forget. Simeon. Where's Simeon belong?
Down here in Judah somewhere.
In Judah. Yeah, in the midst of Judah. Down in the far south of Judah. Levi doesn't have any place in Israel yet. We're going to deal with that in just a second. But here, we're dealing with the sanctuary cities. And we return to this pattern that should be familiar to us by this point in the book, where the Lord comes to Joshua and gives him a command, and then Joshua turns around and gives the command to Israel, and then Israel turns around and fulfills the command. All right, this is that obedience cycle that we are used to seeing in the book of Joshua, and it's a good sign to us whenever we see this kind of thing happening. This commandment that the Lord gives to Joshua is to fulfill what was commanded in the law of Moses. In fact, this is the single largest recollection of the law that we have seen in the book of Joshua. Right, we get the law for the manslayer basically reproduced for us here in the book of Joshua. We've not seen this big of a quotation from the law of Moses in the book of Joshua up to this point. It recounts things that we have already seen and already studied in our law of Moses study. The laws for murder and manslaughter are in Numbers 35 and Deuteronomy 19. We spent quite a bit of time going over those in our Law of Moses class. So I'm not going to rehash like how this law works. It's kind of laid out, you know, what the difference between murder and manslaughter is and how these cities are set apart for those who are guilty of manslaughter so that the avenger of blood doesn't chase them down and kill them. Right? So a relative of the deceased can't hunt them down and kill them for manslaughter. But we're not going to go over all the details and everything today because we've already been over them before. So I'd recommend you go back and read Numbers 35, read Deuteronomy 19. And we did a couple of classes on this. You can go back in our YouTube history and look up the Law of Moses lessons on the Goel. That's the word that's being used here. It means redeemer, or in this case, it's translated avenger. So the phrase here is goel of blood. And this will lay out how all of this works. So, but we're not going to rehash all of that.
Avenger of blood has been a family.
Yes.
So they went to these cities, and that person knew that they could not give revenge in those cities.
Yes.
Because when I think of avenger of blood, I kind of think of like the angel of death. You hear that throughout scripture. I didn't know. Or the Lord of hosts.
Yeah.
An actual
person, yeah. Yeah, so if I found out that somebody had killed my little brother, right, and we lived in ancient times, it would be my job to go seek justice for my brother's death. So basically that initiates a big game of hide-and-seek tag, right? And whoever killed my little brother can flee to one of the cities of refuge, make his case that, no, I'm not a murderer. This was an accident. This was unintentional. And so long as that's the finding of the judges of Israel, then he gets to live in that sanctuary city until the death of the high priest, and I can't do anything. If he leaves the city, I can. But he's safe there. It's basically closest relative. I mean, it would be determined on a case-by-case basis. Yeah. Like what we see in the case of, like, Ruth and Boaz. That's another Goel story, like the kind that doesn't involve killing. But remember, Naomi tells Ruth that Boaz is the closest relative that they have, and so it would fall to him. He's not avenging. Yeah, he's not. But it's the same word in Hebrew, right? It is the member of the family whose job it is to take care of his close relatives. That can be redeeming. That can be avenging. So, yeah. So if you don't remember this material, it's worth going back and looking at, because this conception of, you know, the Goel, that can be a redeemer and an avenger, teaches us a whole lot about the way that God operates. And that's, I think, what this law is intended to do, right? That Jesus is portrayed as our Goel. He is our redeemer. He's also an avenger, and we find that portrayed in the New Testament. Kind of, sort of, it ties more closely to the idea that God himself is going to avenge, right? So like when we see the martyrs in Revelation, asking God, you know, how long until you avenge our blood, right? Like that ties back to this idea that it's not the job, it's no longer the job of anyone here on earth to be the avenger. God's going to take that on himself and do it perfectly. It's kind of like the dietary laws in that sense, in that they're meant to point forward to something bigger and ultimately something spiritual. So the principle is still there. It's that God has taken it on himself. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the sense in which we're supposed to think about it today. So, under the law, it was one of the chief measures of enforcement for how the law was to be enforced. You think they don't have law enforcement back in antiquity. Okay. Now, as we've pointed out, you know, this, because it's a human system, right, it can lead to a lot of mistakes, right, which is the whole reason why we have the sanctuary cities, or why Israel has the sanctuary cities. I wanted to point this out. The ESV in verse 2 translates what the Lord says. You know, say to the people of Israel, appoint the cities of refuge. What that translates in Hebrew more literally looks like, give to yourselves the cities of refuge. Right? The way it's presented is that the giving of these cities of refuge is a gift. Right? That the cities of refuge are a blessing to Israel, that the Lord tells Israel, give yourself these cities. Right, because ultimately, the law recognizes that the imperfect judgments are going to be made, and you need a place of mercy where someone can go and, first off, have their case heard, and second, not suffer the consequences for something that's unintentional. Right, so it's supposed to be a gift to Israel. And we combine this with the idea that the law itself is a gift from God. The sanctuary cities are meant to be a blessing. So, let's continue on through the rest of the chapter. The Lord has given the command to Joshua. Joshua is to turn around and give that command to Israel. And in verse 7, we read obedience. So they set apart Kedesh in Galilee in the hill country of Naphtali, and Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, and Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the hill country of Judah. And beyond the Jordan east of Jericho, they appointed Bezer in the wilderness on the tableland from the tribe of Reuben, and Ramoth in Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh. These were the cities designated for all the people of Israel and for the stranger sojourning among them, that anyone who killed a person without intent could flee there, so that he might not die by the hand of the avenger of blood till he stood before the congregation. All right, so this is where we're going to stretch our brains a little bit. Let me get rid of Dan up here. We are going to see if I can get a different color up here. Let's see if this red works. All right, we're going to go ahead and mark where the cities of sanctuary are at. There's only six of them. There's three on each side of the river. So should be fairly, relatively easy to remember. And some of these are really important because we find a lot of Bible stories happening around these cities. In fact, if we start on, we'll just take them in the order that they're given. So we have Kedesh in Galilee, which is roughly right here. I don't have room. Actually, I'll mark them over to the side here. So this would have been fairly close to where Jesus would have grown up, because he is from the region of Galilee. So you have Kedesh in Naphtali. You have Shechem. This is going to be kind of a mess because everything's close together here. You have Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim. Shechem is right on the border between Ephraim and Manasseh. In fact, Shechem is a hugely important place. It's where there's going to be a lot of people buried there. We're going to see Joseph's bones buried there. Jacob is buried there. There are some other landmarks right around it that we know of already that we'll make that connection later. Really, really important place, though. And then Hebron in Judah, not on the border, a little further south in Judah. So, Kedesh and Naphtali, Shechem in Ephraim, Hebron in Judah. On the east side, we've got Bezer in Reuben. We have Ramoth Gilead in Gad. So sometimes you'll see it just called Ramoth. Sometimes you'll see it called Ramoth Gilead because it's in the region of Gilead. And then we have Golan in Manasseh. All right, I don't know if that's even remotely legible, but this is something we'll add this to our practice at the beginning of each class. We've only got, a couple more classes left. Kedesh in Naphtali, Shechem in Ephraim, Hebron in Judah, that's all west of the Jordan. Golan in East Manasseh, Ramoth in Gad, and Bezer in Reuben, that's east of the Jordan. So three on each side. They are spaced out, or at least they're supposed to be spaced out, so that wherever you're at in Israel, you have some place that you can flee to quickly. That's the essential thing. Let's see. Oh, yeah, I should mention also, Deuteronomy 19, when you go back and you read the law as it's presented in Deuteronomy 19, it also provides that three additional cities are supposed to be set aside if Israel's territory is enlarged. This never happens. And it highlights what we already have started to see from the book of Joshua, that Israel fails to fully conquer even the land that the Lord had originally promised them and given to them. So by the end of this book, the Lord has fulfilled his promise to Israel, but Israel has not fully grasped that promise. And it's going to continue to be a thorn in Israel's side for a long time. And one of the big marks of this is that the Lord had already told Israel, hey, if you guys, you know, there's a chance that you guys can get even more land than what I have initially promised you. So much so that you're going to have to add three more sanctuary cities when that expansion happens. But it never happens. Let's see. All right, so I think that's it for this passage. Any other questions about the sanctuary cities? Yes, yes, more or less. Yes. Excellent point. Yes, ma'am. I think that's something that probably would just get worked out in a situation-by-situation basis. So like, if he has arrived at the sanctuary city, and then the high priest dies before he is able to stand before the congregation, I don't know if we ever read about that happening in the Old Testament, but they would probably still have him stand trial. And if they find him to be a manslaughterer, who knows? I don't know if they would let him go or if they would say, tough luck, here's our new high priest and you're stuck here till he dies. Or if they would just, let him go. If they find him to be a murderer, then he gets delivered over to the Avenger of Blood and he's to be put to death, regardless of the high priest. One at a time. There's only supposed to be one at a time. But it passes on from father to son, basically. No. The high priest over all Israel. Yeah, so whenever the high... So we will find some cases where you have people going to sanctuary cities. Usually the norm, though, is that the person himself, it depends on like a situation-by-situation basis, but the normal place of judgment is supposed to be at the Tent of Meeting, like before the Lord, and that's where the high priest would be, which would require, either the sending of messengers or you send the guy himself under guard, but that's normally where judgment happens. So in this case, it would be in Shiloh.
Or,
no, I mean, the law guarantees that he's supposed to be tried. Yeah. There's still only one high priest over all Israel, and when that high priest dies, anybody who's living in one, forced to live in one of these sanctuary cities, is supposed to be able to go home safely. Now, this is the big, supposed to, is doing a lot of heavy lifting here. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's useful for us to memorize these city names, because you are going to find times in Israel's history where they just straight up disregard this. We are going to find at least one infamous, really bad case where an accused murderer is stabbed in the gut by the Avenger of Blood in the gates of a sanctuary city. So. Yeah, I mean, there's one case in particular that I've got in mind, but we'll, again, it's Israel we're talking about, right? This is, you know, this is the way they're supposed to do things. Cues us in that, remember, Israel almost never does what they're supposed to do, at least after the book of Joshua. Rena?
Two things. You said there was no law enforcement then, so there was no police.
No. So that's something that we go over in our Law of Moses class, but in short, most of it falls to family members, like enforcing justice for themselves, and whenever some kind of judgment needs to be rendered, it usually falls on the priests or the elders of a community.
And then the other question is that if the guy flees to that city, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the thing, is they're not supposed to admit a charge except on the evidence of two or three witnesses. So if there's nobody to present evidence, then there's really not a case.
So there's no police force.
Right.
So I'm just wondering how people
kept free of crime. That is one of the big questions that the Book of Judges is going to come to a lot, and we're going to see that it's a big mess for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. If I remember correctly, yeah.
Right, so those priests would have heard the case right down there.
Yeah.
And
rendered judgment.
On that woman right there, on the evidence that they were given.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have stoned her to death had they found her guilty of murder.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of basically self-police.
More or less, yeah. And that is... Because the norm for what you see in antiquity, the only thing that even comes close to a police force in antiquity, not just in Israel, but like everywhere, is military, like soldiers. Town guard, that kind of thing. Like there's not a whole lot of that around either, most of the time. So most of the time, it falls on individual communities to self-govern, which is why we find things like a kinsman redeemer. Because it's got to be somebody's job to do this. And it's kind of like, you know, it's like getting picked for jury duty, right? Like, you don't want to do it. And the same thing is true of being a kinsman redeemer. Remember in Ruth, Boaz says, there's actually a closer relative of yours that you need to ask first. And remember, the guy doesn't want to do it, right? So he gets his shoe taken off and handed to him. He gets shamed because he won't be a redeemer for his family. But that's, again, because there is no, like, formal law enforcement, we have these kinds of structures instead set up to handle all of those needs, right? Where something has happened, judgment needs to be rendered, the law has to be enforced, somebody has to do it, and usually it falls on a family member. Yeah. That the congregation is to render judgment. Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we find it described in different ways in different places. Like there are places in the law where it talks about the priest, not even necessarily just the high priest, but the priest in general rendering judgment. Yeah, and so, and in other places we read about, it could be the elders of the city, or here it's presented again as the congregation of Israel. We never read of, like, okay, so what exactly does it mean by the congregation of Israel coming together for this? We never read of, like, all Israel getting together in one place to render judgment on one guy who's accused of murder. We have a case coming up that we might consider as somewhat similar. In chapter 22, we're going to read about an altar that gets set up. along the frontier between East and West Israel. And the way that Israel handles that might be instructive for how they would have handled some of these cases. But again, the law, law enforcement is what we would consider today inconsistent, right? Like we want there to be universal norms, like universal standards. Everybody has a police force. Everybody has the same kinds of police force, same kinds of courts. Everybody goes through the same kind of process. And it happens this way every time that somebody does something or is accused of something. And you just don't have that in antiquity. A lot of it is they're working with what they've got. And in some cases, it might be the elders at the gate of that particular city. In some cases, it might be standing before the Lord and having judgment rendered by the priest. Yes, and that's the way the whole law is presented. Is that, again, you follow the law and you won't have any of these problems. And also, if you've got a good relationship with God, God Himself is going to handle the judging, which is the whole point of having the priests involved in any form. Is that you have somebody stand before the priest because the priest is representative of the Lord. And the Lord renders judgment. So like when we read the law in Exodus, almost all of the enforcement comes directly from God Himself. Whereas like in Deuteronomy, the enforcement is usually done like by the king or by some other party. So yeah, there's, like I said, there's this a whole mess of things to consider. So I'd encourage you, if you've got any more questions about this, go back. We did a 2 or 3 part series on this. It was a pretty big study in our Law of Moses class that you can still find on YouTube. So, probably won't answer all the questions, but it'll at least generate some more. All right, let's continue into Joshua chapter 21. Then the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites came to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun and to the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel. And they said to them at Shiloh in the land of Canaan, "The Lord commanded through Moses that we be given cities to dwell in along with their pasture lands for our livestock." So by command of the Lord, the people of Israel gave to the Levites the following cities and pasture lands out of their inheritance. Excuse me. All right, so we've read one land grant for the cities of refuge. Now we've got this second special land grant for the Levitical cities. And this episode is framed as a land grant. Like we've seen stories before in Joshua where somebody comes forward and says, "Hey, I was promised this. Please give me my land." And then they turn around and give them the land. Like Caleb, like the daughters of Zelophehad, and so on. So now the sons of Levi have come and asked for their cities to be granted. One of the things that we're going to see as we read through this chapter is that the Levitical cities include all of the sanctuary cities. And this is provided in the Law of Moses. So in Numbers 35, it specifies that the sanctuary cities are all to be Levitical cities. And so in some cases, it gets kind of confusing, like who all owns this city. Right, like especially in the case of Hebron, it's a sanctuary city in Judah, and it's been listed as part of Judah's inheritance. We're also going to read in just a moment that it is a Levitical city, and so it belongs to the Levites along with the pasture land around it. But we've read of one other person that it belongs to already in the book of Joshua. Caleb comes to Joshua and asks for his inheritance, and he is given Hebron. So a lot of these cities we should think of as like major centers where we would see a lot of different people in Israel intermingling. We've got a lot of different influences over these places. But what I want to focus on for now, the sanctuary cities are also all Levitical cities. And I think part of the reason for that, at least in part, is that you have, in every sanctuary city, you have somebody from the tribe of Levi, you know, these special people set apart by God to act as his priests and as his servants in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And it gets back to what we were saying earlier about how the priest usually played some role in rendering judgment. And so it's no surprise that we find the tribe of Levi in every one of these sanctuary cities. So let's go ahead and there's not a whole lot that I want to say about this chapter. So let's go ahead and continue through. Verse 4. The lot came out for the clans of the Kohathites. So those Levites who were descendants of Aaron the priest received by lot from the tribes of Judah, Simeon, and Benjamin 13 cities. And the rest of the Kohathites received by lot from the clans of the tribe of Ephraim, from the tribe of Dan, and the half-tribe of Manasseh 10 cities. The Gershonites received by lot from the clans of the tribe of Issachar, from the tribe of Asher, from the tribe of Naphtali, and from the half-tribe of Manasseh in Bashan, 13 cities. The Merarites, according to their clans, received from the tribe of Reuben, the tribe of Gad, and the tribe of Zebulun, 12 cities. This is probably where we will stop today. But should remember that Levi had three sons, which gives us three main clans in Levi. You had Kohat, Gershon, and Merari. These form the three clans of Levi. And then on top of that, out of the clan of the Kohathites, special mention is made, or special provision is given, to the household of Aaron. Aaron and Moses were Kohathites. Aaron was the original high priest. And so Aaron's household gets treated as its own clan. And the cities are divided out by tribe. So Aaron gets cities in Judah, in Simeon, and in Benjamin. Notice these are all close together. I'm going to have to do some more erasing because I'm going to run out of space. These are all close together. So the Levites from the house of Aaron would all be down here. This explains, by the way, I think in part, why the Lord ends up causing his name to dwell in Jerusalem. Right? He's already laying the groundwork for that by putting the household of Aaron down here. So the high priest is already going to live among Judah, Benjamin, and Simeon, which is where Jerusalem is at. Right, the other ones, the rest of Kohat lives in Ephraim, in Dan, and in West Manasseh. All right, so again, they're all kind of grouped together here. You've got Aaron here, the rest of Kohat here. Gershon is the only clan to receive holdings in four tribes, in Issachar, Asher, Naphtali, and East Manasseh. All right, so this is where we will end things. All right, so Gershon, you've got in Asher, Naphtali, Issachar, East Manasseh. Notice Zebulun is kind of off by itself. Zebulun is one of the holdings of Merari. We got Zebulun, Reuben, and Gad. Merari gets kind of split up. Reuben and Gad down here, and then Zebulun up here. All right, but this is how all of the Levites are going to be settled out. Next week, we'll go ahead and finish chapter 21. It's just going to give us the list of cities. And so we will look at which of the sanctuary cities end up going to which of the clans. It's going to be divided out pretty evenly, two for each clan. And then from there, we'll be ready to finish the book off with the concluding section, chapters 22 through 24. So thank you so much for your questions and comments and your kind attention this morning.